Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of murder, rape, violence, war, abortion, suicide, racism, and genocide.
Dr. Bailey K. Ashford had just arrived in Puerto Rico following the devastating earthquake known as San Siracio. He witnessed firsthand the devastation it had caused on the island and the way in which it had ravaged the citizens. He endeavored to help the people of Puerto Rico. He learned Spanish, married a Puerto Rican woman, and had three children as he worked and lived as a doctor on the island. Upon further inspection of the countryside hibados, or mountain peasants, Ashford made a discovery. Nearly all the people he examined suffered from anemia caused by an intense form of hookworm. Hookworm has been infecting human beings for around 12,000 years, but the rate of infection in Puerto Rico was incredibly high. Puerto Rico's climate, overpopulation, and poor living conditions turned the island into a breeding ground for the small oval eggs, which, when hatched, would feed off the human body. In other parts of the world, hookworm incapacitated people, but never killed them. In Puerto Rico, the variety of hookworm was so voracious that hibados were dying in droves. In fact, Daniel Immerhoir says, quote, "Anemia was the leading cause of death in the colony, accounting for some 20% to 30% of mortality," unquote. The worms in Puerto Rico were incredibly abundant. They were left in isolation and they managed to evolve into a new species altogether. Puerto Rican hookworms had no teeth. This new form of hookworm gained the apt scientific name Necator americanus, or the American murderer. Thankfully, a cheap pill was able to dislodge the worms, and most people recovered after several days. Thanks to Dr. Ashford's persistence, by 1910, the Puerto Rican legislature funded a national program to cull the disease. This program estimated that over 30% of the population had been cured at less than a dollar per patient. This was not the whole story. Ashford and his colleagues were continually set back in their efforts to cure the island, since most of their patients became reinfected once they returned to work in the sugar and coffee fields. The harsh reality was that these citizens who were poor, had no shoes, and had no access to outhouses or proper sanitation were bound to fall victim to the parasite over and over again. They were trapped in a cycle of poverty, which only worsened due to American overlordship. Basic sanitation, employment-based healthcare provisions, and adequate clothing were all the norm in America by this point. But in Puerto Rico, this wasn't the case. The American government was cold and indifferent to the plight of the hibados in the countryside, but Uncle Sam's interest had been piqued when it came to quote-unquote Americanizing Puerto Rican children. Nelson A. Dennis states, quote, "Every subject, in every class, in every public school was being taught in English," unquote. Few, if any, of the students or teachers understood English, which caused there to be inconsistency in the curriculum. In 1902, the Official Language Act was signed into effect, requiring children to start their day saluting the American flag, reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, and singing the national anthem, all in English. History was taught in order to enforce, quote, American exceptionalism, unquote. In 1909, American authorities decreed it was forbidden to speak Spanish in any classroom setting. In retaliation, children simply stopped attending school. They were threatened with expulsion, but they refused to return all the same. In 1915, American authorities relented to the will of the children, and Spanish was reintroduced into the classroom, albeit in a smaller role. Puerto Rican politics, meanwhile, were in a transitory state. The island was still governed by the backward Four-Acre Act of 1900. Both political parties, the Republicans and the Unionists, were against this act, but they supported different solutions. Republicans supported Puerto Rico becoming an incorporated territory of the United States, which would fast-track the island to statehood. The Unionists did not support a single solution for the Puerto Rican status question. Instead, they wished to amend the Four-Acre Act and grant Puerto Ricans more sovereignty first, and then deal with the status question at a later date. The Unionists would win out in the 1904 election and come to rule the island for the next quarter of a century. They were led by Luis Muñoz Rivera, who emphasized increasing the rights of the Jibaros while expanding Puerto Rican self-government. The party rejected attempts by American authorities to have American citizenship forced upon Puerto Ricans. They claimed this would be a citizenship in name only, since Puerto Rico was still treated like a colony by America. In a strange way, the Republicans, headed by José Celso Barbosa, believed in the same thing, but they supported entrance into the Union as a way to gain true independence from within the American system. They claimed self-government or independence would be detrimental to Puerto Rican interests because this would grant America the right to exploit the island politically, economically, and militarily, which was already the case in countless Caribbean, South American, and Central American states. In 1906, Theodore Roosevelt would become the first American president to visit the island. He was en route to Panama to survey construction of the canal. Upon encountering local Puerto Ricans, he acted much like Columbus had when he encountered the native Taínos. He claimed, quote, "There is something pathetic and childlike about the people," unquote. He wrote later that Puerto Ricans deserved citizenship, but it would be a, quote, "serious mistake," unquote, to grant the people more than that. Roosevelt wrote of the colonial administration, saying, quote, "We are giving them a good government, and the island is prospering. This scheme is working well. No injustice of any kind results from it," unquote. One of the many schemes to which he was referring was the Executive Council. This body wielded executive and legislative authority over Puerto Rico. Additionally, its positions were unelected and not representative of the people's political desires. In 1908, the Unionists crushed the Republicans by a 2-to-1 margin, ensuring a conflict between the Unionists in the legislature and the Executive Council. The clash between the two began when they disagreed over whether or not an agricultural credit bank should be able to assist coffee growers who were experiencing severe loss in the highlands. The Executive Council refused to allow this credit bank to exist, so the House of Delegates called a legislative strike in 1909 and promised to veto any law that was presented by the Council. President William Howard Taft was of the opinion that an amendment to the Four-Acre Act was what was needed in order to quell Puerto Rican complaints. In a special message to Congress, Taft described Puerto Rico as the, quote, "favored daughter of the United States," unquote, while also calling for less autonomy for the island. As a result, the Olmsted Amendment passed the U.S. House of Representatives in 1909. The amendment would give more authority to the executive branch, as anyone in this newly formed department would be appointed by the president. The government hoped this would help them better control the island. Additionally, the act would allow for the purchase of acres of land in larger quantities than companies had previously been allowed to purchase. It would also substantially decrease the number of people allowed to vote in Puerto Rico. After this act passed the House of Representatives, there was an uproar across Puerto Rico, especially amongst unionist supporters. They campaigned so vociferously against the law, even American journalists took notice. This newfound controversy caused the Olmstead Amendment to be defeated in the Senate by a narrow margin. Beyond the objections to the land limitation clause, much of the opposition came from conservatives who did not wish to extend, quote, voluntary U.S. citizenship, unquote, to Puerto Rico. Taft seemingly learned his lesson. In his 1912 message to Congress, he rejected Puerto Rican statehood as a solution and wished to promote a relationship between the island and the mainland which was, quote, analogous to the present relation between Great Britain and such self-governing colonies as Canada and Australia, unquote. Arturo Morales Carrion said this was, quote, the revival of the autonomous doctrine, American style, unquote. Before Taft could act on making this relationship a reality, he lost to Woodrow Wilson in the 1912 general election. The Wilson presidency brought about many changes for Puerto Rico and America alike. Many of the old names which had campaigned for Puerto Rican rights for decades would pass on, allowing for a new generation to take the lead. The general population hoped that when Woodrow Wilson and the Democrats came into office, they would initiate a positive change in the relationship between Puerto Rico and America. Instead, he rung in the era of King Sugar, where three giant absentee-run companies made tens of millions of dollars off the labor of Puerto Ricans, who did not see any of this profit, quote-unquote, trickle down. 80% of the island's population was considered rural, while the people lived in shacks made from cardboard, discarded tin, and, quote, boards torn from packing cases, unquote. In such circumstances, is it any wonder that a labor movement had been growing in strength for some time? Leading this nascent movement was Santiago Iglesias, a lifelong fighter for workers' rights. Following the 1895 strike in the then Spanish Puerto Rico, Iglesias laid the groundwork for a regional workers' federation and was active in printing pro-labor periodicals in Ensayo Obrero, a newspaper which devoted itself to socialist theory. Forced to flee Puerto Rico, Iglesias returned at the head of invading Americans, where he enraptured audiences and pissed off landlords with his socialist oratory. Following the island's annexation, he created the Regional Federation of Puerto Rican Workers. This group campaigned for the 8-hour day, a minimum wage, and the end of child labor. Beyond this, they began celebrating May Day, May 1st, on a yearly basis, and most importantly, they reached out to the incredibly popular Socialist Party of America. In 1899, the socialist movement in Puerto Rico founded the Socialist Workers' Party, who found ready allies within the Puerto Rican Republican Party. This was an era when a good portion of Republicans identified as so-called progressives. So this alliance isn't as mismatched as you might think. Additionally, Iglesias subscribed to the Marxist idea that states would experience socialist revolution only when that state was significantly liberalized and industrialized. This view inspired socialists to pine for American statehood, seeing it as a prerequisite to building a bourgeois liberal state, and thus laying the groundwork for future social revolution. The socialists opposed the exchange of pesos to dollars and insisted on an 8-hour day. This led to a general strike in 1900, but repression and strike breakers were used to cow this movement. Iglesias sought friends in the mainstream labor movement on the American mainland. He found a true ally and friend in Samuel Gompers, president of the American Federation of Labor, or AFL. before this relationship could be cemented, Iglesias had to drop his Marxist and socialist beliefs, as Gompers was an avowed anti-socialist who truly believed in quote-unquote Americanism. Iglesias accepted this policy shift, and he became more mainstream in his opinions as a result. Gompers actively campaigned for Puerto Rican rights, but only in the context of quote-unquote Americanizing Puerto Rican institutions and beliefs. This paternal tutelage was still colonization, just with a prettier name. It denied Puerto Rican perspectives on issues which affected Puerto Ricans. This was the moment when Arturo Morales Carrion wrote, quote, "American trade unionist philosophy would prevail over Spanish labor radicalism," unquote. For his part, Gompers detested the poverty he saw in Puerto Rico and said it was, quote, "a stigma upon the record, the history, and the honor of our country," unquote. This poverty fueled the creation of several local labor parties, culminating in the formation of a new-look socialist party in 1915. The new socialist party would garner much support and become a strong third-party option in the next election. Additionally, there were several massive strikes in 1915, which were aimed at protesting the miserable working conditions within Puerto Rico's tobacco industry, which was experiencing severe economic shock. It was hoped that change would rapidly take place between the mainland and Puerto Rico. However, Wilson cared little for directly involving himself in the debate. He wished someone in Congress would take charge of solving the relationship status problem. William Atkinson Jones, a representative from Virginia, put forth a bill which would grant American citizenship to Puerto Ricans, while also allowing the island to have an elected legislature. This bill still barred Puerto Ricans from choosing their own governor, but it was a step in the right direction. It took 3 years to gain the support of the Puerto Rican people and American Congress for the bill. One key factor that led to the passing of the bill was the American acquisition of the Danish West Indies. America, acquiescing to the Danish government's request, had granted Danish West Indian citizens American citizenship in order to seal the deal on their purchase of the island. Knowing this was the case was sure to inflame the inhabitants of Puerto Rico, who had been living under American rule without being granted American citizenship for some time now. Luis Muñoz Rivera had been arguing passionately for the island to come together around the Jones Act. He had been tirelessly writing, speaking, and traveling between Puerto Rico and Washington. Arriving in Puerto Rico on September 19, 1916, Muñoz Rivera fell ill. He had a high fever, and doctors assumed it was brought on by overexertion, but in reality, he had suffered a ruptured gallbladder. Septicemia set in and poisoned Muñoz Rivera. Put under emergency surgery, which proved ineffective, there was nothing to do but wait for him to die. On November 15, 1916, Muñoz Rivera finally succumbed. He left his children with little money but attempted to instill in them the value of a good education. Arturo Morales Carrion concludes, quote, "He was a man severely tried by history," unquote. His death brought all Puerto Ricans together at a crucial moment in the debate over the Jones Act. Even then, Wilson had to step in and personally intervene to get the bill through the Senate. He believed maintaining Puerto Rico's loyalty would be of the utmost importance as war with Germany loomed on the horizon. Citizenship was now granted to all Puerto Ricans under the Jones Act, but those who chose to were able to opt out of their American citizenship and retain their Puerto Rican citizenship. Hard on the heels of the Jones Act came the Selective Service Act, which gave American authorities the right to conscript Puerto Ricans in times of war. This was all rather convenient for America. But above all, the Jones Act was a bandage placed over a serious wound. Ed Morales says, quote, "The ambiguous state of Puerto Rico that the Jones Act cemented set the stage for the island's unstable future," unquote. Prohibition of alcohol was a final crucial aspect of Puerto Ricans being granted citizenship under the Jones Act. Puerto Ricans felt that enforcing prohibition would grant them more freedoms or self-government in the future. In a referendum, over 100,000 Puerto Ricans supported the coconut, a symbol of prohibition, while just 60,000 supported the bottle, the symbol for legal boozing. Alcohol was, of course, smuggled into the island, while DIY distilleries produced Ron Cañita and Alambique. Prohibition continued for decades until FDR had the amendment overturned in 1933. Republicans in Puerto Rico viewed the attainment of U.S. citizenship as a forerunner to statehood for the island. Beyond celebrating the passage of the Jones Act, they actively petitioned and campaigned for an elected governor. This supposed victory for the Puerto Rican Republican Party in Washington did not ensure their victory on the island. The Unionists still controlled the island politically, winning the election of 1917 by a precarious 4,700-vote margin. Their main competition was the Socialist Party, which was ascending in popularity every election cycle. The alliance, or quote-unquote coalition, between Republicans and Socialists proved crucial in radicalizing the former and reforming the latter. This coalition suffered a serious blow on September 21, 1921, when José Celso Barbosa passed away. His genius, drive, and optimistic view of American institutions inspired an entire generation of future pro-statehood leaders to finish the work of making Puerto Rico a part of the United States. Besides Muñoz Rivera and Barbosa, another pillar of Puerto Rico was about to give way. José de Diego was one of the founding members of the Unionist Party and is considered by many to be the, quote, father of the Puerto Rican independence movement, unquote. Following the death of his friend Muñoz Rivera, de Diego took up the Independentista banner like never before. He campaigned for Puerto Rican independence and rejected the false compromise of the Jones Act. Much like de Hostos, Betanzas, and Muñoz Rivera before him, de Diego never lived long enough to see his dreams set in motion. He died in 1918 after years of suffering from flatworm, which turned his leg gangrenous and poisoned his blood. The Unionists, meanwhile, were splintering into factions. Several influential members broke off and formed the Nationalist Party of Puerto Rico, which advocated for outright independence from America. A feeble husk of moderate Unionists remained, but they would soon be rallied by a new force in Puerto Rican politics. In our series, Links in the Chain, we discussed America's involvement in World War I and its effects on the country's working people and its authorities. One aspect of American involvement in the war, which is rarely, if ever, mentioned in American textbooks, is the thousands of Puerto Rican citizens who participated in the American war effort. Besides being drafted, many showed a patriotic zeal unmatched in American states. War bonds were purchased at a vast rate on the island, and the people committed themselves to rationing. Of the thousands of Puerto Ricans who served, few saw real combat in the Western Front. However, the Puerto Rican regiment was instrumental in defending and garrisoning American overseas possessions. Besides serving on the island, Puerto Ricans were deployed to the Panama Canal Zone and were in the process of training for active combat deployment when the war ended. In time, Puerto Rican soldiers would play a crucial role in the wars to come. Arthur Yeager was appointed as governor during this time. He was an old school friend of Woodrow Wilson, but he proved to be one of the most respectful and fair governors the island had had. Yeager was practical. and he worked with both Unionists and Republicans to achieve reform throughout Puerto Rico. He replaced white Americans with Puerto Ricans in education and civil service. Yeager recognized that Puerto Ricans needed more self-government, not less. He asserted that given time and freedom, quote, the next two decades will see even more wonderful progress and development, unquote. In 1920, Warren S. Harding was named president, and he needed a replacement for Yeager. Yeager gave the new president some honest advice. Yeager said he should avoid appointing some quote-unquote super patriot to the position and should be considerate of Puerto Rican sensibilities. Harding ignored Yeager and appointed his buddy, Emmett Montgomery Riley, as the new governor. Nelson A. Dennis says, quote, in four short months, Riley had managed to insult every politician, journalist, farmer, teacher, priest, and bootblack in Puerto Rico, unquote. He began his time in office by taking his oath in Kansas City, and then taking 2 months off for, quote, personal business, unquote. He utilized the Puerto Rican press to make a few announcements to his people. He claimed he was, quote, the boss now, unquote. He demanded the island become a state. He claimed Puerto Ricans who opposed him or statehood were, quote, professional agitators, unquote. Finally, he bragged about how much money he made and how the governorship of Puerto Rico was the, quote, best appointment President Harding could award, unquote. When Riley finally decided to show up, he threw down the gauntlet. He said there was, quote, no room on this island for any flag other than the stars and stripes, unquote, while also referring to the Puerto Rican flag as a, quote, dirty rag, unquote. This effectively lost any goodwill Riley still had. The press began lampooning him mercilessly. They referred to him as, quote, darling Caesar, unquote, while islanders called him, quote, Mancho Reyes, unquote. This moniker, while being a name for suckling pigs roasted over a fire, literally meant King of the Congenital Idiots. The nonsense continued. In April 1922, charges were formally brought against Riley for misuse of public funds when vast discrepancies were reported. In one example, Riley supposedly took $5,000 from the Puerto Rican Treasury because he claimed the island, quote, owed him, unquote. In February of 1923, after months of mockery and derision, Riley tendered his resignation. Horace Mann Towner replaced Riley. He learned quickly from Riley's vast array of mistakes and realized he had to work with the Unionist Party in order to achieve success on the island. Towner's rule was defined by early economic success, as well as increased tension in labor disputes and in politics. New ideas were forming about the sort of relationship which should exist between the United States and Puerto Rico. José Tussotto was a Republican who began openly advocating against both statehood and independence. Luis Muñoz Morales was a Unionist, and he put forth the idea of the Estado Libre Asociado, with a free associated state. This promised proposal was meant to be the best of both worlds. The island would be a free state while still being associated to and protected by the United States of America. These two forces came together in Puerto Rico and created the Alianza between the Unionist Party and dissident anti-statehood Republicans led by Soto. The socialists and the mainstream Republicans continued vying for supremacy against this new threat, but they were never able to top this new combination. Realizing the inequity on the island was unsustainable, Towner proposed and implemented a more progressive tax on the wealthiest living in Puerto Rico. He also attempted to save the island's fledgling coffee industry, which still had not properly recovered from San Siracio. Additionally, there was increasing concerns over the sugar industry. only three companies controlled 45% of the arable land in Puerto Rico, and profits had been steadily declining for years. Calvin Coolidge replaced Hoover in the mid-1920s. He had a disdainful view of Puerto Ricans, and when they beseeched Washington for more rights, he reacted with an angry letter directed at the island's politicians and inhabitants. He said that the island was prospering because of American generosity, and that Puerto Ricans should not seek more self-government. In September 1928, another massive hurricane, San Felipe, crashed into Puerto Rico. Besides killing hundreds, displacing hundreds of thousands, and causing irreparable damage to sugar and coffee haciendas, the hurricane crippled the island's economy. The Great Depression struck in mainland America in 1929, which further hampered emergency response. Sugar and tobacco prices reached all-time lows. Fernando Pico says, quote, "The Depression represented a death knell for the battered agrarian economy of Puerto Rico," unquote. Wages fell as prices ballooned and basic goods became luxuries. The poverty which gripped the island was astounding, and it fueled the growth of massive slum communities outside of San Juan and other major Puerto Rican cities. The way of life Puerto Ricans had known for 600 years had been decimated by the greed of imperialist creditors 1,000 miles away. Suicide and homicide rates skyrocketed, alongside an increase in strikes and political radicalization. The last governor of the Hoover era was Theodore Roosevelt Jr. For his part, Jr. attempted to learn all he could about Puerto Rico and tried to teach himself Spanish to no avail. He had a colonizer mentality but believed the, quote, white man's era, unquote, was ending. He believed that, at some point, control should be given over to the native people. To his credit, he saw no reason to continue the drive towards, quote-unquote, Americanization, saying it was hopeless to expect Puerto Ricans to act like mainlander Americans. He supported vocational schooling, funded agricultural centers which helped peasants acquire land, and instituted agricultural cooperatives which could compete against sugar monopolies. In spite of these helpful initiatives, poor wages and rapid inflation meant little change was witnessed by the average Ibado. The level of wealth inequality and land inequality was staggering. 4 out of 5 Puerto Ricans were landless, while only 477 individuals, almost all of them American, owned an average of 500,000 acres of land each. Sugar latifundia had increased by over 262% since the American invasion, while absentee companies owned 59% of the wealth. In politics, the alianza between anti-statehood Republicans and the Unionists was floundering, and new voices were calling for statehood as a way out of economic despair. In 1929, the dissident Republicans returned to the old party's fold, but there was a resurgence of Unionist support which gave the party enough leverage to carry the election. Roosevelt Jr. was growing wary of heading the ship, and wished more than anything to leave the island for good. In 1931, he was appointed the governor of the Philippines, and he left Puerto Rico in a hurry. This was perhaps for the best, as the coming decade of Puerto Rican history was one of violence and turmoil which would define the island and its people. The new president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, promised a new deal for all Americans, but Puerto Ricans got a raw deal instead. He used police violence, state propaganda, and the FBI to turn Puerto Rico into a surveillance state. Beyond this, Puerto Rico became home to genetic and human experiments, which were absolutely atrocious and inhumane. FDR attempted to stem the immense poverty on the island. He believed the main problem in Puerto Rico was the intense overpopulation, saying, quote, "The only solution is to use methods which Hitler used effectively. It's all very simple and painless. You have the people pass through a narrow passage, and then there is a burr of an electrical apparatus. They stay for 20 seconds, and from then on, they are sterile. Unquote. Sterilization was nothing new to America. Eugenicists felt that the mass sterilization of overpopulated areas, which were made up of, quote, inferior races, unquote, was the most humane thing to do. Many state laws, which targeted mentally inferior and, quote unquote, promiscuous people, were upheld by the Supreme Court. Puerto Rico was the most affected by far. At one point, one-third of the entire female population of Puerto Rico had been sterilized. This made the island home to the largest population of sterilized women in the world. Over 20,000 women were sterilized in the municipal hospital of Barceloneta alone. Many were forced to have tubal ligation surgery without their knowledge. It was referred to as La Aparición. Beyond this genocidal use of sterilization, there was immense controversy which surrounded Dr. Cornelius P. Rhodes. He arrived in San Juan in 1928, spearheading a Rockefeller-funded research project into anemia on the island. After getting drunk at a party, he emerged to find his car vandalized. Afterwards, in true Caesar clown fashion, he wrote to a friend, quote, "I can get a damn fine job here, and I am tempted to take it. It would be ideal except for the Puerto Ricans. They are beyond doubt the dirtiest, laziest, most degenerate and thievish race of men ever to inhabit this sphere. It makes you sick to inhabit the same island with them. They are even lower than the Italians. What the island needs is not public health work, but a tidal wave or something to totally exterminate the entire population. It might then be livable. I have done my best to further the process of their extermination by killing off 8 and transplanting cancer into several more. All physicians take delight in the abuse and torture of the unfortunate subjects." Unquote. This letter was discovered and made headlines throughout the island. Dr. Rhodes quickly backtracked and claimed he was only joking. Regardless, an investigation was launched and even more horrific news came to light. Nelson A. Dennis says, quote, "Jose Ramon Quiñones confirmed that of the 13 recently deceased cancer patients at San Juan Presbyterian, 8 had indeed been in Rhodes' care," unquote. Another letter, which was supposedly, quote, "even worse than the first," unquote, was uncovered as well. But Daniel Immerhoir says, quote, "the government suppressed it," unquote. Rhodes would go on to become chief of medicine in the chemical weapons division of the U.S. Army. He set up laboratories in Utah, Maryland, and Panama, and his advancements in the field earned him a Legion of Merit Award in 1945. Following the war, Rhodes served as an advisor to the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, where he specialized in nuclear medicine. The Rhodes Affair was a turning point in Puerto Rican history for several reasons. First of all, it made Puerto Ricans deeply afraid of doctors, which engendered unnecessary suffering. Secondly, it proved a white American who claimed to have murdered people could get away with it, so long as those who were murdered were not white. Finally, it proved to nationalists like Pedro Albizu Campos that the time had come to break free from American dominion and pursue a Puerto Rico first policy. Albizu Campos was born out of wedlock in 1893. His mother was a mestizo while his father was a white Puerto Rican who refused to acknowledge his own son. Albizu Campos' mother was a deeply troubled woman who suffered from mental illness. She wandered the roads with her son and neighbors took to calling her La Llorona, the weeping woman. One day when Albizu Campos was 4, his mother walked into the Rio Bucaná and was carried off to sea. She was never seen again. Campos was taken in by a maternal aunt who lived in the neighborhood. His aunt inspired his moral compass, his religion, and more than likely his politics. Albizu Campos was a phenomenal student, who completed 8 grades in 4 years and then graduated from high school in 2 years with a 96 average in all subjects. Due to his amazing grades, he received a scholarship to the University of Vermont. In 1913, he transferred to Harvard College and became the first Puerto Rican admitted to the Ivy League school. He graduated with honors in 1916 and was admitted to Harvard Law. Albizu Campos was known as a quiet and reserved student. His only impulsive gesture was asking Laura Manese to marry him after 3 days of dating. They remained partners for life. When World War I began, Albizu Campos eagerly volunteered for the conflict. He served as a first lieutenant, organized and trained the 3rd Battalion Infantry of Puerto Rico, and was the only officer who was a person of color on base. During this time, he traveled extensively throughout the Jim Crow South, where he encountered intense racism. He saw the true face of America, and he wanted nothing to do with it. Most Americans couldn't locate Puerto Rico on a map, let alone pronounce the island's name correctly, so why would Puerto Ricans ever wish to associate with such people? Albizu Campos immersed himself in law and the founding documents of many quote-unquote liberal countries. He read the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, and countless other treatises on government and politics. All of these documents preached self-determination and the rights of man, but he asked himself, where were these rights for Puerto Ricans? He met with countless foreign dignitaries, especially those of the Irish nationalist movement. He even assisted Eamon de Valera with constructing the Irish Free States Constitution. Albizu Campos was determined to see Ireland free and spoke in favor of complete Irish independence on many occasions during his stay in Massachusetts. Besides this, he met with Indian anti-imperialists who were likewise attempting to cast off their British oppressors. Following the war, Albizu Campos returned to Puerto Rico and rented a small wooden house in Ponce. He became a founding member of the Nationalist Party, of which he soon gained complete control, demanding absolute loyalty and commitment to the cause of Puerto Rican independence. Throughout the 1920s, the Nationalists grew in popularity due in part to Albizu Campos's intense style of oration. Starting in 1927, he departed for other Caribbean and Latin American nations, where he attempted to find common ground with other revolutionary movements who were also trying to end American imperialism in their own countries. His personal popularity was not enough to win the Nationalists many votes, as Puerto Ricans preferred to vote for the established parties. By 1932, Albizu Campos had lost all hope in the democratic process, seeing it as just another tool of manipulation used by colonizers to keep Puerto Ricans from gaining any true autonomy. Running parallel to the Marxist nationalism of Albizu Campos was the democratic socialism of Luis Muñoz Marín. The son of Luis Muñoz Rivera, Muñoz Marín had spent his youth as a quote-unquote poet in New York City. He wrote articles to stay afloat and was beginning to experiment with opium in one of the city's many drug dens. His arrival on the island and his family's name propelled him into the spotlight. It didn't hurt that Muñoz Marín also controlled his father's newspaper. He ran with the socialists at first, but couldn't comprehend their allegiance to the Republican Party. He reformed the Unionist Party as the Puerto Rican Liberal Party, alongside former Unionists. From here, Muñoz Marín made a concerted effort to assist the Ibaro of the countryside, realizing that this was the vast majority of the Puerto Rican electorate. The economic burden on the island was already heavy when another hurricane, San Ciprián, struck the island in 1932. A little over a year later, the newest governor, Robert Hayes Gore, arrived on the island. He was a wealthy man who had made his fortune selling traveler's insurance through newspaper ads. He made a 20% commission on each sale, netting him over $1 million per year, adjusted for inflation. He supported the Democratic Party with large donations, and this was apparently all the expertise he needed to be named governor of Puerto Rico in 1933. Besides being unsure of where the island was, Gore had other failings which were somehow worse. Before even arriving, he threatened the president of Cuba with an American invasion. When he arrived, he announced several reforms his administration would pursue. Nelson A. Dennis says these included, quote, an international cockfighting carnival in order to boost tourism, disloyal teachers removed from the school system on the grounds of treason, less Spanish in classrooms and preferably none. He wanted Educational Minister Jose Padin removed immediately because he was too pro-Puerto Rican, unquote. Additionally, he wanted to relocate tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, or Texas. Finally, and most bizarrely, he declared his intentions to train nightingales on the island to sing the Star Spangled Banner. The reaction of Puerto Ricans was immediate. Strikes gripped the University of Puerto Rico, which was less than a decade old, while a bomb was detonated at Gore's summer home in Jojome Alto. An agricultural strike exploded in 1933, which soon swept the island. Gore proved incapable of stopping the work action. On January 12, 1934, President Roosevelt accepted Gore's resignation. Before he left, Gore gave a final fuck you to Puerto Rico. He uprooted the trees surrounding the governor's mansion and had them smuggled back to his home in Florida. The next man chosen to lead Puerto Rico was General Blanton Winship. A native of Macon, Georgia, he had three goals in mind when assuming the governorship of the island. He wanted to plant gardens in order to boost tourism, reinstate the death penalty, which was abolished in 1929, and he wanted to militarize Puerto Rico. In this final objective, he succeeded. An airbase, which cost Puerto Ricans $112 million, was constructed. The island of Vieques became a massive naval base, and the police were retrained and rearmed with military-grade firepower. Besides being sent to end the labor actions, which threatened private profits, Winship was sent to Puerto Rico to silence the increasingly militant Nationalist Party. This militant wing called itself the Ejército Libertador de Puerto Rico, or the Liberation Army of Puerto Rico. Additionally, the army had a youth wing known as the Cadets of the Republic. Both groups trained in tactics, survival, and self-defense. Besides the men in the army's ranks, there were many female nurses, referred to as the Daughters of Freedom. They all marched behind the flag of Puerto Rico and the Nationalist Party flag, an all-black flag with a white cross at its center. It symbolized the Puerto Rican nation, which was mourning its loss of freedom. For the same reason, the party's members wore black shirts. These symbols were somewhat fascist in nature, but many nationalists espoused socialist and pan-Caribbean ideals. That being said, Albizu Campos practiced an intense form of Roman Catholicism. This influenced the Nationalist Party's policies, as they were actively against birth control and abortion. Additionally, Albizu Campos was an avowed homophobe who believed 2SLGBTQIA+ individuals should be quote-unquote punished. The Army of Liberation and the Cadets modeled their revolution off of the Easter Rising of 1916 in Ireland. They understood that they could never seriously challenge American military might, but they might be able to drum up enough support for independence at home and abroad by making themselves martyrs. Federal authorities began involving themselves in the Nationalist Party because Albizu Campos was at the forefront of negotiating the end of a labor strike. workers were now making twice as much as they were before, thanks to Albizu Campos' negotiations. In a last-ditch effort to end Albizu Campos' agitations, American authorities asked him to relent on his rhetoric. In return, they promised Albizu Campos the governorship. Albizu Campos replied by stating Puerto Rico, quote, wasn't for sale, unquote. In 1935, four nationalists were killed by police in the Rio Piedras massacre. Police were heard shouting, quote, not to let them escape alive, unquote. But this testimony was ignored, and the police officers responsible were never charged. The FBI, meanwhile, had been tracking the nationalists and Albizu Campos for some time. In fact, since its inception, two high-ranking members of the Army of Liberation were FBI informants. One was the brother of the commander of the army. The other was responsible for training all new recruits. The chief of police, Francis E. Riggs, declared, quote, a war against all Puerto Ricans, unquote. Puerto Rican nationalists responded with ferocity. 3 months after the Rio Piedras massacre, two nationalists walked up to Riggs and killed him. The two were apprehended, but once they arrived at police headquarters, both were executed by vengeful police. Authorities attempted to pin the murder of Riggs on Albizu Campos, but they had no evidence tying him to the event. Instead, they charged Albizu Campos with, quote, conspiracy to overthrow the government of the United States, unquote. This charge was incredibly dubious and nearly impossible to prove when the facts were presented to a jury of Albizu Campos's peers. During a retrial, the majority Puerto Rican jury was exchanged for a largely white American one. The result was that Albizu Campos was found guilty and charged with 10 years in federal prison. He would spend a majority of this first stint in Atlanta, Georgia, and would be released on probation in 1943. He would not return to the island until late 1947. On March 21, 1937, a parade was scheduled in Ponce to honor the cadets of the Republic, as well as to protest Albizu Campos' imprisonment. The nationalists made sure to obtain permits for the event, and hundreds of families arrived to support their loved ones. It was Palm Sunday, so many of the cadets and onlookers carried palm leaves on their shoulders. 80 cadets were cheered on as they marched to the tune of a five-piece band. All at once, the mayor of Ponce arrived alongside the insular police captain. Behind them were 200 heavily armed police officers. The mayor was now claiming that parade permits had been rescinded at the last minute by order of Governor Winship. The officers of the cadets and the mayor argued for a few minutes before Lopez de Victoria became fed up. He called on the band to play the Puerto Rican national anthem, La Boriqueña. Then a shot rang out, striking Ivan Rodriguez Figueras. Nelson A. Dennis says he, quote, crumpled like a rag doll, blood spurting from his throat with each dying heartbeat, unquote. Juan Torres Gregory was watching the parade from his window when a shot from police killed him. A third shot hit Abdulio Rosario, who fell to the floor bewildered and died. The police had created the perfect kill zone for the Puerto Rican nationalists, so even when panic took the crowd, there was little room to run away. A boy on a bicycle was mowed down. A father was shot in the back defending his dying son. An orange vendor who was hiding behind a statue of Jesus was hunted down and executed. An old man was practically ripped in two by Thompson submachine gun fire. The flag bearer was immediately felled, as was the next brave soul who attempted to carry the nationalist flag to safety. Eventually, a young boy managed to retrieve the flag. The police kept shooting. They shot a young girl who was seeking shelter in a church. They shot another man who was a National Guardsman who was on his way home. They clubbed a 53-year-old woman's head so hard that the gray matter of her brain spilled out onto the floor and caused several people to slip and fall. At this point, many guns were overheating, but this did not stop the police from firing into corpses and shooting several people begging for their life. Bolivar Marquez de Lechia was struck at some point during the massacre. Before dying, he wrote in his own blood, quote, "Long live the Republic, down with the murderers," unquote. By the time the firing had stopped, 19 people were dead. Two of them were police officers killed in their own crossfire. 200 other Puerto Ricans were severely wounded, writhing in agony on the ground. It is, to this day, the worst massacre committed against civilians by police in American history. The two dead policemen were a godsend to the Puerto Rican chief of police, Enrique de Orbeta. He set about covering up the massacre. He grabbed the journalist on hand and forced him to take quote-unquote real-time photos of the police scanning the rooftop for quote-unquote snipers. Now, Puerto Rico's police could claim they were defending themselves. Unfortunately for the PRPD, there was a filmmaker in the top room of a nearby hotel who had a bird's-eye view of the entire massacre. His damning film confirms there was no snipers, and the Ponce massacre was simply a cold-blooded execution of nationalists and their supporters by the police. Beyond the video evidence, the ACLU arrived on the island and, after an intensive investigation, declared that what occurred in Ponce was indeed a massacre. Instead of quelling insurrection in Puerto Rico, all the Ponce massacre did was inflame the population further. 20,000 Puerto Ricans marched alongside the caskets of those killed. Authorities quickly went about falsifying witness testimony and threatening the family members of those shot. The district attorney resigned from his position rather than bring charges against people for, quote, killing themselves, unquote. A loyal lackey was quickly placed in his position. Those suffering mental and physical ailments following the massacre were arrested at the hospital. Fortunately, none of these charges would stick. Luis Munoz Marin had been living and working on the island for 6 years when the Ponce massacre occurred. He never kept up with his studies like his father wished he would. As a result, Munoz Marin never had a full college education. Instead, he spent his time gallivanting in New York City and writing poetry. In fact, he spent most of his early life in New York, completely abandoning his wife and children and often asking them for more money. In spite of this roguish lifestyle, Munoz Marin deeply loved and respected his father. He wrote at his eulogy, quote, "I would like to be a giant, to embrace the mountains that he contemplated in his boyhood. The mountains for which he struggled from his youth onward. The mountains that sheltered his countrymen, the Jibaros. And that today entomb his body. I would like to be a giant, to hold close to my chest all these Puerto Ricans who keep forever in their noble hearts the sacred memory of my father. And I would like to be a giant to complete the work of Luis Munoz Rivera, the giant of Borinquen," unquote. In 1932, after finally running out of money and being cut off by his wife, Munoz Marin returned to Puerto Rico. Using his name and platform as a newspaper editor, Munoz Marin ran for the Puerto Rican Senate and easily coasted to victory. By 1940, he had gained control of the Liberal Party and began advocating for Puerto Rican independence under an American protectorate. Making crucial contacts in Washington, Arturo Morales Carrion says Munoz Marin became the FDR administration's, quote, "golden boy," unquote. Munoz Marin's support of FDR proved crucial in the passage of several relief bills specifically designed to tackle the complex Puerto Rican economic situation. The Federal Emergency Relief Administration and the National Recovery Act were both utilized to tackle poverty and poor working conditions on the island. things had become so bad that Muñoz Marin was calling Puerto Rico, quote, Uncle Sam's second largest sweatshop, unquote. With the backing of Washington, Muñoz Marin was integral to enforcing the 500-acre statute, which was a dead letter from the 4-acre act. Additionally, he condemned the violence which swept the island in the mid-1930s. Millard Tidings, a senator from Maryland, was horrified at the violence in Puerto Rico as well. He put forward a bill which would grant Puerto Rico immediate independence, but his bill gave the island no economic safety net. This would likely crash the Puerto Rican economy even further, so Muñoz Marin attempted to have the bill defeated. He claims to still have supported Puerto Rican independence, but realized that the economic constraints of independence would severely hurt the island. Tidings would introduce a similar bill in 1945, which was less draconian and more advantageous to Puerto Ricans, but it failed to gain serious support. Muñoz Marin claimed the second bill turned him against Puerto Rican independence, though historians have speculated other reasons behind his change of heart. This whole time, Governor Winship refused to resign from his position. He claimed his officers acted with quote-unquote restraint during the Ponce Massacre. Additionally, he laid the groundwork for the carpetas, or secret files on hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans. These carpetas were used to justify arrests, searches, and espionage. These files were monitored by hundreds of FBI agents who lived covert lives in Puerto Rico. A year after the Ponce Massacre, Winship added more fuel to the fire. On July 25, 1938, a massive military parade was held in Ponce to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the American invasion. It was heavily protested, and at one point during the parade, a nationalist rushed the dais where Governor Winship was standing. He fired at the governor, but a National Guardsman threw his body in the way and was killed. The shooter was also killed, and this event soon sparked mainland protests. One of the loudest voices protesting was the socialist representative of East Harlem, Vito Marcantonio. On May 11th, he said, quote, "The tyrannical acts of the governor in depriving the people of Puerto Rico of their civil rights, the corruption and rackets that existed, were made possible by the indulgence of the governor and the extraordinary waste of the people's money," unquote. The next day, Winship was removed by FDR. Before leaving the island for good, Winship became a lobbyist for sugar interests in Puerto Rico. His job was to make sure that the Fair Labor Standards Act did not apply to Puerto Rican workers. Once more, Vito Marcantonio took umbrage with Winship and rallied to the side of Puerto Rico. He said, quote, "In keeping with his 5 years of terror in Puerto Rico, he acted the part of the slimy lobbyist and fought by means fair and foul to have the wage and hour law amended so that the sugar companies could pay 12.5 cents instead of 25 cents an hour and thereby gain $5 million a year, so that the system of abysmal wage slavery could be perpetuated in Puerto Rico. Up to the very closing days of Congress, this kicked-out governor fought to have Puerto Rican workers removed from the protection of the wage and hour law," unquote. Ironically, Winship would go on to prosecute Nazi war crimes in the Nuremberg trials. While the system of violence, coercion, and oppression he created in Puerto Rico would be utilized by new men to bring more suffering to the island. The coalition of Republicans and Socialists would finally win the majority of seats in the legislature in 1936, but this victory would be fleeting. Santiago Iglesias was now an old man, and he seemed unable to control the varying factions within the Socialist Party. In 1939, he fell ill with malaria, and his health rapidly deteriorated. He died just as the Socialist Party began to fray and collapse. The pro-statehood Republicans were faring no better. They were under the control of the strongman Rafael Martínez Nadal, whose style fractured the Republicans. they now supported either him or Miguel Ángel García Méndez. The liberals were also reaching a point of no return. Conservative elements within the party who feared independence challenged Muñoz Marín for control of the party's helm. These forces were led by Antonio Rafael Barceló, and he succeeded in seizing the party's leadership. Barceló began purging the liberal party of its most radical followers, including Muñoz Marín. Left totally adrift, Muñoz Marín would have been relegated to the dustbin of history were it not for the extraordinary times in which he was born. War clouds were swelling over the horizon once more, and once more Puerto Rico was considered, quote-unquote, too damn important to not protect. The island became a focal point in the battle against German U-boats, which operated in the Caribbean and the Southern Atlantic. Tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans would be called on to serve, and they would prove their mettle in several of the crucial campaigns toward the end of the war, which secured the Allied victory against fascism. In the hills of Puerto Rico, Muñoz Marín was building a grassroots, cult-like following amongst the poor Jibaros. He rallied the peasants to his banner with a simple slogan, Pan, Tierra, Libertad, bread, land, and liberty. Beyond this being a new era for Puerto Rican politics, the Puerto Rican economy was changing. King Sugar was no longer in charge. Now industrialization swept the island. The population was nearing 2 million people, and besides being incredibly young on average, Puerto Ricans were drifting away from the countryside in greater numbers. Most people were still unbelievably poor. A report in 1945 described the situation thusly, quote, 75% of them never had more than the barest necessities of life. The average Puerto Rican lives a life of want from the cradle to the grave. Born of parents who are afflicted with hookworm or malaria, suffers from malnutrition in childhood, and spends his entire life in a crowded shack with no sanitary facilities whatsoever. Unquote. In such a climate, Muñoz Marín's political platform of populism, self-government, and democratic socialism took hold. He was calling on the peasants and proletarians of the island to join together under his new party, the Partido Popular Democrático, or the PPD. The PPD was a mass political party which appealed to a vast majority of the island's population. The party was not interested in quote-unquote Americanization, and they gave no clear preference for Puerto Rico's future. They had their cry, Pan, Tierra, Libertad, Muñoz Marín, and not much else. The party had no money and was ridiculed by the mainstream political parties at first. Several factors assisted the PPD. The first was the death of Barceló in October of 1938. The next was a revision to the electoral laws in Puerto Rico. These decreed universal suffrage and a system of closed polls which represented all parties. Finally, the parties were a mess, and this helped the PPD immensely. The coalition was still going strong, but their message reached a limited number of people. Who had specific interests. Then there was the Unificación Puertorriqueña Tripartita, which was a splinter group of various ideologies attempting to reforge the Alianza of yesteryear. The results were as muddled as the parties competing. The coalition received the most votes, over 223,000. The PPD was a close second with over 214,000 votes. In last place, the Unificación garnered just 130,000 votes. The true victor, however, was the PPD, which now controlled the Puerto Rican Senate by a single seat. The results annoyed many liberals and socialists, who complained that the PPD's platform was extremely similar to theirs. Regardless, the 1940 election would begin 26 years of dominance by the PPD, which mirrored democratic hegemony on the mainland. As with the start of the Spanish-American War and the Great War, World War II was the main event which allowed these changes to occur. The island was a key point in a defensive triangle between the tip of Florida and Panama. Without the island under U.S. control, supplies would not be able to flow as smoothly or securely through the Panama Canal. American authorities felt they were still in a precarious position in the region, so two fields of thought were put forward. Rexford Tugwell, soon to be Puerto Rican governor, suggested a, quote, welfare-oriented U.S. imperialism, unquote, in which American forces would protect Caribbean governments from subversives for the betterment of all parties involved. The Department of State put forward their own solution, which favored what Arturo Morales Carrion called a, quote, Pan-American trust scheme, unquote. This approach would bind the economic interests of Caribbean nation-states with those of American creditors and monopolists. Muñoz Marín bided his time. He said neither social justice nor self-government would come to Puerto Rico if democracy was extinguished throughout the globe. Fighting in France, the Italian campaigns, and the last battles in Germany, the 65th Infantry Regiment would suffer a total of 47 battle casualties throughout the war. Almost 100 medals would be given out to the soldiers of the regiment, who went away with a mixture of feelings about the conflict. Some believed the war would bring America and Puerto Rico closer, while others saw the conflict as the exact reason Puerto Ricans should be free and able to choose their own fate. In 1946, this feeling was put into political action with the birth of the Puerto Rican Independence Party. The 65th Regiment would go on to see action in the Korean War, where it gained renown for saving numerous Allied forces. Following two mediocre governorships, FDR finally placed a man in charge who had the ability, empathy, and tact to lead the island. Rexford Tugwell was the last appointed governor of the island, and he helped lay the groundwork for the easy transition to self-government. He petitioned FDR and then Truman for Puerto Rican self-government numerous times. In the meantime, he passed several major reforms which were designed to combat the economic depression which still rampaged across the island. Tugwell called on Puerto Ricans to collaborate with the American government and turn the island into the strategic center for the spread of liberal democracy across the Caribbean. He set up a public water and transportation company in 1941 and 1942 respectively, enacted a minimum wage, and reformed the educational system at the university level. The coalition was still a powerful opposition, and the most conservative elements inside two parties disparaged the rapid pace of social change. Some went so far as to call Tugwell a, quote, communist, unquote, a charge also levied at FDR for similar reasons. Tugwell and Muñoz Marín, who was a Puerto Rican senator at the time, worked together to get legislation passed in the face of such criticism. Like FDR, Tugwell was trying to reform capitalism in order to save the system from itself. Tugwell appeared before the Senate in Washington and made his case for a self-governing Puerto Rico. He said, quote, 2 million people cannot permanently be kept in the twilight of colonialism, unquote. He claimed no appointed governor could truly be effective at their job. Instead, the right should be given to the people to choose their leader. Once granted a choice, he claimed the people would industrialize and modernize at a rapid pace. He sided with Muñoz Marín and his version of democratic socialism. Roosevelt was finally listening, and in his 1942 message to Congress, he called on the Jones Act to be amended and allow for an elected governor on the island. Unfortunately, nothing happened as war raged across the globe. The 1944 Puerto Rican elections saw a landmark victory for the PPD, which was now surging in popularity. Under Muñoz Marín's leadership, Puerto Rico transformed like never before. For the first time in its history, the island was urbanized and industrializing at a rapid pace. This rapid economic growth was fueled by Operation Bootstrap, which emphasized several points in Puerto Rican development. First, taxes for big businesses were cut, which incentivized the migration of many factories to the island. 65,000 veterans were returning home, and they provided an ample amount of surplus labor for the new factories. At the same time, migration offices were set up to encourage Puerto Ricans to move to mainland America. This began the so-called Great Migration of Puerto Ricans to urban centers on the East Coast. Many ended up in New York City, where they became Neo-Ricans, but there are also sizable communities of Puerto Ricans living in Cleveland, Detroit, and Florida. Next, unused land in Puerto Rico was distributed to the peasantry through a massive government-funded program. This improved the livelihoods of many jibaros, and the income generated through taxes in Puerto Rico more than doubled during the island's industrialization. In December 1945, Tugwell announced his intention to resign as the governor of the island. The Truman administration had several paths before them. They could name a Puerto Rican governor, they could hold an election for a governor, or they could hold a referendum on the island's status. Truman chose to appoint a Puerto Rican to the post for the first time. In February 1946, he amended the Jones Act, and that July he appointed Jesus Tipiñero to the position of governor, with the intent of elections being held soon. Piñero cut taxes for foreign companies, legalized gambling, and contracted Hotel Hilton to build the Carib Hilton in 1947. He would serve for over 2 years before giving power to the first elected governor in Puerto Rican history, Luis Muñoz Marín. The same year that Piñero was named governor, Muñoz Marín came out against independence for the island. He now claimed Puerto Ricans were not as ready for self-government as he once thought. Why the sudden change? Nelson A. Dennis says this was likely the result of an FBI document which outed Muñoz Marín as a drug user. Around the same time, Pedro Albizu Campos was at a local barbershop, the Salón Boricua. Albizu Campos now had a posse of FBI agents tailing him wherever he went. Once in the salon, Albizu Campos would use the restroom, where he had a 5-minute window of freedom. He removed a false panel from the wall and shimmied into the next door apartment, where his lieutenants from the Revolutionary Army waited for him. He discussed strategy and community outreach. Beyond this, he discussed launching an armed rebellion against American authorities on the island. He called for arms and ammunition to be stockpiled in the empty apartment. These were arms which had been, quote-unquote, redirected from one of the many U.S. Army garrisons on Puerto Rico. Albizu Campos would shimmy back into the barbershop's bathroom and flush the toilet. In those precious moments, FBI agents were none the wiser. Vidal Santiago Diaz, his barber, would ask him, quote, "Did an agent follow you in?" unquote. Albizu Campos would respond, quote, "He tried, but I wouldn't let him," unquote. This terse exchange was actually code that the meeting had occurred. Besides being Albizu Campos's barber, Santiago Diaz was probably the most famous barber on the entire island. He was a graduate of a prestigious barber school in Arecibo and had literally written a book on being a barber. Besides his shop giving out haircuts, the salon could also give out loans for the poor, a drink for the thirsty, and the news of the day. Born in the town of Aguas Buenas, Santiago Diaz's father was a lector for many tobacco factories. The lector, or reader, read newspaper articles, novels, and announcements to tobacco workers as they rolled their cigars. Besides being a demanding job, readers took great pride in teaching sophisticated theories to workers, many of whom could not read. In 1926, the United Puerto Rico Sugar Company began buying up all of the tobacco plantations in Aguas Buenas, and Santiago Diaz's father was out of work. He had no choice but to begin harvesting sugarcane alongside his son and the people to whom he once read. He would die of a heart attack while working right next to his son. After graduating from school, Santiago Diaz made a promise to himself to never cut sugarcane again. He went to find work in Santurce and stumbled into the salon on a whim. He met the owner, Jose Maldonado, who hired him instantly because he knew Santiago Diaz's grandfather. In time, Maldonado would shape Santiago Diaz into a master barber who could give a perfect haircut in 14 strokes or less. One day in May 1930, Albizu Campos came to the salon for the first time. After this initial meeting, Maldonado pulled Santiago Diaz aside and explained a stunning revelation to him. Maldonado explained that he was Aguilla Blanco, the White Eagle, who had led revolutionary forces against Spanish and American soldiers in the 1890s. Next, he explained the true purpose behind the Salon Boricua. He had contacts inside the U.S. Army supply system, who provided Maldonado with 5,000 meals for a cheap price. In turn, Maldonado sold off the rations at a pittance to poor families. His generosity kept upwards of 50 families afloat. In September of the same year, Maldonado went to the local hospital, San Juan Presbyterian, to seek treatment for anemia. His doctor was the same Cornelius Rhodes who is alleged to have killed 8 Puerto Ricans. He gave Maldonado several shots which he claimed were, quote, iron injections, unquote. In a matter of weeks, Maldonado complained of being unable to swallow food properly. A lump soon developed on his throat, and in early 1931, Maldonado was diagnosed with throat cancer. Later that same year, Jose Maldonado was found dead in the bathroom of Salon Boricua. Maldonado's will stipulated that ownership was to pass to Santiago Diaz, who set up a wall commemorating the White Eagle and his father. He continued receiving illegal shipments from the army and using the food to feed the needy. Now, however, instead of just food, Santiago Diaz was asking for, quote, special items, unquote. Weapons and ammunition were now a part of each monthly delivery. For 10 years, this steady flow of arms became an arsenal of dozens of weapons, several knives, and thousands of bullets. Santiago Diaz soon became integral to the Nationalists and their armed revolutionary cells. He was promoted to captain and was found drilling his cadets in army tactics in the hills on most weekends. On December 15, 1947, Albizu Campos returned to the island. In June of 1948, the Puerto Rican legislature passed the infamous gag law. This draconian law was similar in language to a law in the United States which precipitated the second Red Scare. It declared the flying of the Puerto Rican flag illegal and also made it a crime to criticize the government. Things were about to explode on the island. Something was about to snap. Years of government surveillance, racism, and colonialism were laying the groundwork for a different sort of American revolution. Cells of resistance fighters would besiege several major cities on the island, and civil war alongside political violence would sweep the countryside. The only other time such violence held modern-day Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans hostage was immediately following the Spanish-American War, when the Tiznados laid bare the contradictions in Puerto Rican society. Likewise, the Nationalists would lay bare the precarious state of law and order on the island. To hear the story of the 1950 revolution in Puerto Rico, as well as how Puerto Rico became a commonwealth, only to lose political consensus and begin a steady economic decline, you'll have to tune in to the next episode of Turning Tides. I'm your host, Joseph Pescone. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, even a little teeny bit, please leave a rating and review to help us reach more people. Thank you all so much again.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, M-O-V-O-P-H-O-T-O. Thank you again.